Hello and welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I'm Tyler Smith.
I'm David Bax.
And thank you for listening. David.
Yes.
How you doing?
I'm doing all right. I watched a movie last night. I have not yet logged it on Letterboxd.
So
here, you know what? I want to get our... Well, actually, I don't even know if I need to get our guest's opinion on this, because our guest very famously does not do star ratings on Letterboxd. Just like or not like. But our guest is the Battleship Attention third chair, Scott Nye.
Scott. Sup?
So the first part will apply to you.
Okay.
I, as a rule, won't log a movie on Letterboxd until I've slept on it. I will...
Interesting.
I will do it the next day, and that's when I'll do my star rating and everything. Do either of you have rules like that?
I would say anything that you ask, if we have a rule similar to yours, it's probably not going to happen.
I know. I once wanted to do an episode about our little, like, movie-related, like, I don't know, idiosyncrasies, yeah. But I'm not sure if you guys have enough.
I think you can do that episode.
Just on my
own. I don't think you need us for it.
Yeah. No, I mostly just log when I remember. I try to do it right after I see it, but it's not always practical.
And then the next question, so I watched a movie last night. I watched, I'm not going to remember both the director's names, Jimmy Chin and, anyway, Emily Chai something's Naiad. And as of this recording, I have not logged it yet.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about my star rating
now,
and what
now,
it means.
How are we defining logging it? Does that mean, like, adding it into, like, the ranking
of
your
year? Oh, right, because you don't do a diary thing. You just mark it as watched.
Correct,
so,
yes.
So, yeah, setting that aside, like, what I want to talk about is what the star ratings mean to you. Because I was thinking about how, like, I'm probably going to end up giving Naiad 3 stars, which is technically positive, but I consider damning with faint praise.
It is insane that you're thinking about this, because just yesterday I was looking at other people's Letterboxd. I'm like, okay, at what point does their star rating start to feel negative to me? And it's 3 stars. 3.5, it's like, all right, we're getting close.
Well, I once saw someone on Twitter or Blue Sky or something describe 3.5 stars as the coward's rating. And I fully, like, I do it sometimes, but that is, like, it is fully,
that,
like, in terms of, like, your review at work, 3.5 stars
right.
Meets expectations. That's yeah. What that is. 4 stars for me is exceeds expectations.
Yeah.
And then I've said before that the difference between 4.5 and 5 stars for me is not something I could put into words. I just know.
And I think for me, I agree with that 100%, but also I feel like for me, 3 to 3.5 is, I know this is not very good, and yet some part of me likes it. You
okay.
know, and that's what that extra half star is. Like, it's not enough. I didn't like it so much that I'm able to ignore some of the issues with it and get it up to 4 stars. But I can't, in good conscience, give it 3 when I enjoyed it this much.
Right.
That's right. Kind of how I look at it.
Yeah. And then as far as the negative scores, I feel like I then get into the mode of, like, I feel like if it's 3 or above, I'm putting it for my own, like, future reference, so I can
yeah.
go back and see. Once you get below 3, it actually becomes, like, how much do I want to warn people away from this movie? So if I think a movie is really, like, a waste of time, or it maybe is, will have a negative effect on the world, that's a half star.
Yeah.
Anything else in there is just sort of, like, it, like, the difference between 4.5 and 5, it's kind of a feeling as to whether I do 1, 1.5, 2, 2.5.
Yeah. It's based on how angry it makes me,
yeah.
usually.
Yeah.
Like, if I give something 2 stars and I'm angry at myself for not rating it lower, it's like, all right, well, that means it probably should be lower than that.
Right. all right. Well, that's what I wanted to talk about at the top. We have a lot of episode to get to, but first I want to tell you about tweakedaudio.com. Tweakedaudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. I use them each and every day of my life. Today, yes, I know it's like mid-February at this point, but yes, I am still in 2023 mode, as I am with movies right now. I'm still watching 2023 movies. So I re-listened to what I think is the sophomore album by a band called Caligram. It's called Ex Sister. I'm guessing that's some sort of... Oh, no. Sorry. No, that's one of the songs. Position Momentum is the name of the album. It's called Position Momentum. And I often feel, even though I've been like... I've spent a lot of time listening to metal for the last like decade of my life, but I've always fallen short of calling myself a metalhead. I think because like that sort of world is so gatekept and so insular that I don't want to like, it feels like calling yourself a metalhead is like some sort of like throwing a gauntlet and like asking to be challenged. And one of the reasons is I sometimes wonder if my tastes follow trends too much, but then also maybe the trends are trends because that's where the music's good. I don't know. But Caligram, a band that kind of formed during the pandemic, which those bands are always interesting to me, in this second album, they're very much on trend, on trend with being a sort of punk informed black metal, but that's so up my alley right now. But I don't know, is that just because it's the trend? I don't know. But in any case, it sounded great on my tweakedaudio.com earbuds that are available at a low, low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get one third off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season two is out now from Lemonada Media.
Okay, we're back.
Yes.
Tyler, Scott.
Yeah. Hello.
We are like really on the runway now to our top 10 of the year. Well, we started with last week, Scott and Julie's top 10.
It's interesting when you said that you're still in 2023 mode. This is how like far removed I am from regular people. Is it like, for me, I don't even understand why a studio would release a movie before March. Like, I just, like, when I saw, like, oh, Argyle came out and now Madam Web or whatever.
Yeah.
I just think, like, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? you really should just hold off until the spring, right? And then I realized, like, oh, right, not everybody is obsessed with, like, seeing everything in 2023 that they can. Some people actually want a lighter mainstream movie this time of year.
Well, the box office is so soft this year, though, that I think a lot of people are on your same wavelength.
Really?
But
there's been some good counter-programming so far this year with Scott and I are both fans of Night Swim.
Hell yeah.
Not the critical community at large.
It looked fun to me. I really want to see it.
Audiences seem to be loving The Beekeeper.
Yeah, mysteriously.
And I will also recommend, to a point that that Scott, I think you were just making on Twitter or something recently, about how like there's a certain brand of like programmer type movies that don't get appreciated until.
This is my new like secret cause that I'm constantly shouting about.
Well, I know, as a fan of rom-coms and stuff, I know you're not an Amazon user, but I would recommend Upgraded, the rom-com on Prime.
Oh, I was curious about that.
As is typical of streaming movies, I don't think I've heard of this one.
Yeah, it's Camila Mendes, who played Veronica on Riverdale. I didn't watch Riverdale, but I think that's what she's best known for. Supporting cast includes Marissa Tomei and Lena Olin. Mm. Anyway, it's about a woman who basically...
It's Upgraded, just for the listeners.
Did I just say Upgrade?
You just said Upgrade.
Okay, Upgraded, yeah. So it's a woman who like goes on a... She's an intern on a low-level trip. She gets upgraded to first class and meets a rich guy and sort of like pretends to be on his level and financially, and they fall in love.
It looked very delightful.
Yeah, it's good. So yeah, that's the counter-programming that we're talking about, but that's not what we're talking about here today. Here we are today talking about our personal favorite individual achievements. Now, as I say every year, I'm saying favorite with an asterisk, because next week, I have the same speech every year. Next week, we'll do Through the Cracks, movies that aren't on our top 10 or even on honorable mentions, but that we think deserve more attention anyway. And I kind of always bring that energy to the individual achievements. Yes, if it were, like when we get to supporting actor, if I were being fully honest, Charles Melton would be my pick.
Sure.
But a lot of people have been talking about Charles Melton.
And he's a BP nominee.
And he's a,
I try to avoid that too.
I'll be going in a different direction. I feel like we generally all do some version of this.
Yeah, I also don't have anything that was on my top 10 because I just talked about it. And so it's like, I don't want to keep repeating myself weeks to come. So.
Yeah, I'm definitely, some of these movies will be in my top 10 in a couple weeks. Or might, not because I'm still watching movies.
Yeah.
I'm still catching up. There's a movie that I'll be talking about today that I watched two nights ago.
Yeah.
So let's kick things off. Scott's going first, but Tyler... What category are we starting with? Which category are we starting?
There we go. Thank you. Let's start with lead actor.
All right. Well, this was an easy one for me because the film very nearly missed my top 10, but it's Franz Rogowski in Iris X Passages. Undoubtedly the best male performance of the year to me. He's playing a filmmaker who's working on his latest film, in the midst of which he's having strife with his husband that's clearly been going on for years and years and years. And he meets a young woman played by Adele Exarchopoulos, whom he sleeps with and quickly leaves his husband for, surely any of us can relate to leaving anyone for Adele Exarchopoulos.
Even Paddington himself.
But he's just playing on the surface a very despicable character who makes all the wrong choices and just using people in his life. But Rogowski's performance and Ira Sachs' writing and direction kind of give him a slight sympathetic edge. Sachs has talked about how the character is semi-autobiographical, just in the way that like directors through their profession learn to be able to like have everything they want, and that can bleed into one's personal life in sometimes dangerous ways. And Rogowski's performance, I mean, he's just like one of the best working actors right now, and he's so physically interesting. Even shots of him that are just from his back are so expressive and strange and weird, and kind of give edges to the character that aren't in the dialogue or in any more emotive scenes, but which he is so captivating throughout, even when you're not seeing his face. And in addition to which, he just makes a great asshole of a character. Great asshole is strange to say for a film in which you probably do see his actual asshole. But it's a fantastic performance. I've seen the film three times now, and each time there's more and more layers to it that I see.
All right. So my pick for best actor, we don't have a best ensemble category in individual achievements because that wouldn't make sense. It's individual achievements. But I will say this is kind of a stand-in for what I'm about to say about this actor applies to most of the like major cast of this movie. So I'm going with Christian Friedel for The Zone of Interest. Because he's on the same wavelength as Jonathan Glazer, as are the rest of the cast, in the thing that I keep, having seen it twice now, the thing that I keep marveling at with Zone of Interest is how it manages to maintain my interest while also never softening the characters or getting into the, you know, there's that old saying that I've brought up before about that you can't make an anti-war film because by depicting war it like glorifies it or something. This is a movie that like is about a high-ranking Nazi SS commandant that makes him a person but never makes him in any way forgivable or any way like something that you could that you can see the humanity in. He's still a person all the time, but he's disgusting. And I said I've seen the movie twice, which is shocking to me because I said after I first saw it that I probably would never watch it again because it's a stomach churning experience.
But then your mom came to town and you're like, you know what?
My
aunt, anything's going to get me to see it again.
And also I hadn't been to the Vista yet since it opened. So it was fun to go to the Vista, where I had a celebrity sighting, Tyler, whenever you're finally willing to do Patreons again, I've got so many celebrity sightings.
Oh, me too.
So yeah, I'll no, I forgot what I was saying, but basically that's what I'm talking about. That I guess I know at least one of us in this room has not. Well, I know only one of us in this room has not seen Zone of Interest, so I'm guessing some of the listeners haven't. So there's certain things that I want to leave to be discovered, So I want to dance around this, but there's a scene where he and some of his kids are in the stream, and near their home, which is outside of Auschwitz. And then what are clearly human remains start coming down the stream, dump off from Auschwitz. And he's obviously disgusted and panicked to get his kids out of the way of that.
Yeah.
But also he's responsible for that.
Yeah.
Being able to play both of those things without it becoming either tipping too villainous or too sympathetic, just really jiving with the rigor of Jonathan Glazer's approach.
Man, I'm so upset that I haven't gotten to see the movie yet. Like, every new thing I hear about it, and I try not to hear that much stuff, but every new thing I hear about it just sounds just fascinating and just totally engrossing. Okay, so my choice for lead actor is an actor that I'm on record as not being the biggest fan of, but I feel like the work he's been doing in the last few years has really turned me around on him.
What was Will Patton in this year?
I'm trying to think if I've ever fully turned around on him. I've seen him in some stuff where it's like, oh, that's pretty solid. No, I'm talking about Joel Edgerton in Paul Schrader's Master Gardener. Did either of you see it?
Yeah, I saw it.
I did not.
Yeah. Did you like it?
I was mixed on it. Don't think it sold the romance. I don't think it overcame the central problem with the romance enough for me to really really grapple with it in a way.
I could see that.
Yeah.
But I almost feel like that's a little bit on purpose. Anyway.
I know. People keep saying that. I'm like, eh.
Yeah, it's tough to know.
Yeah.
With Paul Schrader, you never know.
Yeah, for sure.
But I won't spoil anything, but Joel Edgerton is his character is a man with a past, and when we discover what the past is, it's even worse than we thought it was going to be. But it's the kind of performance that just pushes all of my pleasure buttons, because it's someone who is very aware that he has a past and is trying to be better than that and trying not to be discovered and all of that stuff. And as a result, it's a very careful performance. Like, this is a guy who just everything about his life is about holding stuff in and not letting too much of himself show. And it just kind of naturally comes with feelings of shame and guilt and just, I don't know, just he seems to always be holding himself in check, not necessarily because he's still is that person from his past, but because he worries that he absolutely could be. Or if he's not careful, he could fall back into that. On top of, he doesn't want anyone else to find out. And so it's just such an in-the-moment performance. Like, at any moment, you feel like he is right on the edge. And not on the edge of, like, exploding, but on the edge of just letting everything come out. And, it means everything to him to not let that happen. And it's just, I feel like you don't see performances like that very much. And it really worked for me.
Yeah, and I think what I do find affecting about the movie, and what I have increasingly found affecting about Paul Schrader's movies in general, is that kind of like element of, you're just talking about, of withholding, but also that he, and you see this with Taxi Driver and Light Sleeper and Card Counter and First Reformed and so many Paul Schrader movies, of like guys who are trying to hold something back about themselves but end up finding salvation by letting it out. Mm-hmm. And I've honestly found that somewhat therapeutic. Obviously, I'm not going to go be shooting people up like his protagonists do, but there, I think there's an element of that that I think is a real moral underpinning to his movies that is sometimes under-discussed.
Would you say that also applies to Affliction?
I still haven't seen Affliction.
Oh, boy.
I know. It's high on my list.
That might be the exception that proves the rule.
Okay, interesting.
Because, it's all about this guy not wanting to let himself be his, like, abusive alcoholic father.
Okay.
And then it just keeps slipping through, and you're like, oh, boy, I don't like where this is headed. But, yeah, you should check it out. I love it.
I know. It's been on my list for too long now.
It's interesting you say that you have not always been a fan of Joel Edgerton, because I very much agree, but also kind of turned a corner with 13 Lives.
Damn right.
I thought he was quite good.
Yeah, really good in that.
Yeah.
Maybe I should.
And I never saw The King, but my friends who are fans of that kind of thing say he makes a really great Falstaff. Hmm. So I'm really curious about that. Okay.
Yeah, what's our next category?
The next category is going to be screenplay.
All right. Stop.
And this can be adapted or original.
Yeah, this was a film that kept bouncing around my honorable mentions, my top 10, all kinds of things, but figured this is a good place to spotlight it. And it's Christian Petzold's A Fire. I was kind of... This was a film I was kind of mixed on at first. Petzold has built such a good reputation of crafting really unique and captivating and like galvanizing endings to his films. And I think the ending of A Fire is a little soft. But the texture of the film and the way he builds the various conflicts in it, is so intricate and interesting and counterintuitive. And his characters are so rich and fascinating. It's about a writer, who's working on a second novel. His first was like some measure of success, but he's really stuck on a second novel, and he goes kind of on this retreat to like a family friend's cabin with a friend of his. When they get there, they discover a woman's been staying there who the friend had like accidentally double booked the cabin, and so already his like whole sense of calm has been thrown off. She's played by Paula Beer, and probably my favorite of the performances she's given in Petzold's films. And she's kind of like, he kind of regards her as like too much of a free spirit. She's very like flighty and unreliable, and is like working at an ice cream stand. He's just kind of like looks down on her while he has this great noble pursuit of crafting a second novel. And it's really becomes about his own narcissism and sense of self-importance and how much that's blinding him, not only to others and what they could, and the kind of people that they could be, but then what he could be for them and like enriching his own life. And all of this is taking place against the backdrop of a looming forest fire that's kind of off of the distance, but kind of increasingly encroaching on things. And that kind of functions as like a really good metaphor for climate change and all kinds of looming disasters right now. But stacked against the character work, it just all forms a really good sense of looming dread and strange sources of tension, and all the characters still within this kind of like what could seem, as I'm describing it, as too kind of structured. All the characters still feel real and impulsive and intuitively drawn, and like they're really just reacting to the moment. It's a film that's really stuck with me much more than I expected it to when I first saw it.
I feel like I should say something because I've seen the movie, but yeah. It's good. It's not my favorite of the recent Petzolds. I'm a bigger fan of Barbara than I think you are.
Yeah.
But I think we both liked Undine.
Yeah. I mean, I liked everything else of his I've seen. Barbara's really the outlier. Transit's probably still my favorite.
But yeah, so yeah, that's an original screenplay. I chose an adapted screenplay, adapted from Brock Yates' book, Enzo Ferrari, The Man, the Cars, the Races, the Machine. Troy Kennedy Martin's screenplay for Ferrari. I haven't read, my guess is from the title of the book that it's more biograph, more all-encompassing,
I'm guessing.
The movie Ferrari very much focuses on a very specific time in Enzo Ferrari's life. And so what I appreciate about what the screenplay does is taking the... I feel like we've seen too many biopics where usually about like successful men whose dedication to their craft hurts their home life.
Right.
Sure. There's too much of that. This movie makes the two things inextricable from one another by making the two storylines about the same thing, which is the movie is centered at a point when the legacy of the name Ferrari is in jeopardy, both in his love and family life and in his business and company and professional life. And so, yeah, for taking things that I would not be surprised to learn that the timelines were fudged for the movie.
Almost certainly.
Yeah, that sort of thing doesn't bother me. So by taking those two threads of his life and making it about the same thing in different forms, that's what I loved about the screenplay.
All right.
It's worth noting that Troy Kennedy Martin died over 10 years ago. That's how long this film has been in development. They started developing it shortly. It would have been shortly after that biography was published. That was published in 1981. I know they've been developing since the 90s. But yeah, he wrote the original Italian Job, and this was, of course, the last produced screenplay. And I understand that Michael Mann did some rewrites on it, obviously. You would have to. But apparently, yeah, it stuck pretty much to what they developed along the way.
It would definitely fit in, I feel like, more with Michael Mann's films in the 90s. Like,
totally,
if you look
yeah.
at Manhunter and Heat and The Insider, like, it's very much all about, like, these men that are trying to do this thing, but they're also trying to deal with, like, their personal life and their marriage and just the way these things are incompatible.
And the filmmaking, too, is a lot more classical than his more recent efforts, which have been divisive.
Yeah.
I haven't seen Black Hat.
So. I like it.
I love Black Hat. That was on my top 10 that year.
I know a lot of people really like it. I need to see it. So outside of like some TV work, I don't think I've seen anything since Public Enemies, which is the last one. Black Hat's the only one in between those two, right?
I think so.
I believe so, yeah.
There's he did the Luck pilot,
right?
Which was really great. And then I didn't watch the Ansel Elgort. What was that?
Tokyo Vice.
Tokyo Vice. I didn't watch that.
That's right. People have been telling me that it's really good and that I need to see it.
I heard that the pilot's really good and then it kind of drops off after that.
Got it. Okay, so I'm not going to get any of these names right.
Perfect.
So sorry in advance. My choice is an adapted screenplay. It is Ariella Bearer, Jordan Schroll, and Daniel Goldhaber's How to Blow Up a Pipeline. Man, that's a good script. Like, the structure of it is perfect. They do such a good job of making it a true group effort. Like, yeah, there are a couple of characters that could be seen as being the leads, but not really. Like, you really understand, like, how everybody has a part to play. Everybody has their own reasons for doing this, and everybody has a different personality. Like, some people you're very sympathetic to. Other people are like, this guy's kind of a jackass. But the idea that everything comes together, like, it really lives up to the title. Like, you look at it and it's like, do you want to know? This is basically how you do it. And it also
functions. Which is funny because the book very famously doesn't do that.
Right.
Oh, really?
That he even says in the movie when the kid from Blackish, I can't remember his name, he's in the bookstore and he picks up I don't think you ever see the cover, but he picks up how to blow up a pipeline, and the books, the other guy says, you know, it doesn't actually tell you how to build a bomb. But yeah, I mean, this is adapted. You know how in the 90s there used to be like CD soundtracks that would be like music inspired by Spider-Man 3 or Spider-Man, whatever?
Yeah.
That's what this is, kind of like There Will Be Blood being based on oil. Like,
right.
The story is like essentially wholly original, just
like
inspired.
Fast by Food Nation is similar to that as well. But yeah, and so, and it also functions, I think, as kind of a mystery. It sort of unfolds that way, where there's stuff going on that you're not privy to.
Yeah.
That unfolds naturally, so that you have you finally wind up with the full picture. And there's just something about, like, it's completely naturalistic in its dialogue and its characters, but you get a sense of who everybody is. And there's some style to the structure of it. And man, I just thought it was like one of the best scripts of the year.
Yeah. And I was going to say, is like, especially on the ensemble point, I think that lack of understanding who the main characters are is so essential to making, there ends up being like a twist of sorts. Yeah. Just like the revelations that occur, not knowing who we're supposed to be paying attention to is a really smart decision there.
Yeah.
I mean, you likened it to a mystery, but the clear analog here is a heist movie.
Yeah,
that's totally. Exactly.
Absolutely.
That sort of like Ocean's 11 thing of like, we're seeing them work, but also we're learning what the plan is as it's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, oh shit, they made it. An exact replica of the pipe.
Yeah.
Man. And it goes for like 6 miles. It's also very suspenseful.
Oh, yeah.
On top of everything else. It really is. Listeners, if you haven't seen it, check it out. I believe it's on Hulu and it's worth a watch. Okay, so next up, we're going to go with Supporting Actress.
Supporting Actress.
All right, this was a tougher one for me to nail down. I'll throw a nod to Jodie Foster and I, which would probably be my choice if I actually thought that was a supporting performance. I know it's been categorized as that, but I really think it's a co-lead, if not the lead of the film.
Oh, interesting.
So instead, give a shout to a performance that I think is not getting enough credit, and that's Vanessa Kirby in Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1.
She is good in that.
Not only has she become like so captivating as this kind of like amoral jack of all trades arms dealer, but the performance she gives in the train sequence where she has to be playing Haley Atwell playing her is the kind of acting that's so textured and nuanced, but also can't be showy. Because so Haley Atwell's on the train in a mask to play as Vanessa Kirby's character. But Haley Atwell's like new to the spy game, so she's not as confident as like when Ethan Hunt wears a mask. So she's giving away a certain amount of herself, but not so much that ends up foiling the whole plan. And it's also not like Haley Atwell has a lot of like tics that Vanessa Kirby can be playing along the way to give those kind of like indications of like, and like be showy about it. But she has to give enough that the audience feels the tension that Haley Atwell is experiencing of like the whole plan could fall apart at any time. And it's so, I mean, I've seen it now twice, and especially the second time I watched it, I was like, she is really like detailing this character in ways that go far and beyond anything I think we've seen before in these like masking scenes in the Mission Impossible series, and really kind of elevates that scene to a whole different level. I've been quite taken with Vanessa Kirby as an actress on the whole. When the new Fantastic Four cast got announced, someone was like, they just got a bunch of TV actors there. But I think Vanessa Kirby's kind of proved her mettle in the feature realm, and her work here is good evidence of why.
It's the kind of performance that no one ever talks about, but like so much of this movie hinges on that performance being exactly what it is. It needs to be convincing enough for the characters, but it needs to show us that like, show us what we know, which is that like she is very nervous and does not have a lot of confidence in herself, and because it's a performance that, for lack of a better term, like is imperative to the plot, I feel like people don't think of it from a character standpoint.
Totally.
But it absolutely is, and that's a great choice.
Thanks.
I'm a big Vanessa Kirby fan. I think it's insane to call her a TV actress. That's she hasn't been on The Crown in 6 years. I just had to look.
Is it that long? Wow.
I don't know, man.
Well, it says she appears in an episode in season 5, but I don't know if they did some sort of flashback.
Flashback, yeah. I would say.
But yeah, she was only in the first two seasons of the Crown as Princess Margaret, and then Helena Bonham Carter played her in 3 and 4, and then I didn't watch 5 and 6. I don't know who played Princess Margaret in 5 yeah. and 6. But, or 6 hasn't happened yet, right? Yeah. Anyway, that's not important. What's important is that I really like Vanessa Kirby, and I obviously haven't seen Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 or Napoleon, which she was also...
Oh, she's so good, Napoleon.
But I would direct people to an underseen movie from 2021 called Italian Studies.
Okay.
She plays a woman who gets amnesia and walks around New York for 80 minutes.
Sweet.
Yeah. wait, oh shit, I'm up.
Don't okay. put that phone away.
So mine... I could be accused of cheating because this is such a substantial role
yeah.
that it many people probably might think of it as a co-lead, but fuck it, I'm going to play by my own rules. And I'm going with the great Juliette Binoche in The Taste of Things.
Hmm.
The Taste of Things is a romance, and it's a movie about food. But I think what's great about Juliette Binoche's performance is how well she understands, how well the character understands herself and her place in the world and what she wants. And that, like, the fact that the romance between Juliette Binoche and Benoît Magimel starts off as that she's his employee... is not really lost on them, like that's a crucial part of how she plays the character. Not that it's, I'm not talking about like it's a Me Too, like he's exploiting his power type of thing, just that she has an understanding of her station in life and it's what she wants. There is resistance on her part to pursuing the romance. I think because she's so self-possessed and sure of herself and her,
yeah,
and her place. That journey to her, like, sort of acquiescing to becoming his wife, but also like still insisting that she's like the cook first in a way.
Yeah,
that's. At that point, it becomes literal. She actually says it, but I feel like that that character's desire to remain in the kitchen is present in her performance up until that point as well.
Yeah, and it's like such a physical performance because all the actors did their own cooking on the film. There's no like doubles for any of the work. Yeah. And so we have to get... just in that whole like long, I don't know how long it goes on, like 30, 40 minutes preparation, meal preparation scene in the beginning. We have to get all of the passion she has for it and the patience it takes to execute a meal at that level, at that time in history, with the tools they had.
Yeah.
And how much, you know, it's like so trite to be like, there's so much love in the cooking, but like how much genuine passion and like
yeah.
expression goes into it.
Yeah, I want all those all that copper cookware. It looks
so I know, right?
man, I wish I so enjoy cooking now, and that's one of those things that like I can't believe I waited so late into life to like enjoy cooking. Like I was so impatient.
Well, that's the thing. I think it does require a degree of patience.
And that's it's weird that it feels weird that one acquires patience as you get older. Because
yeah, it should be like, I'm running out of time.
You're running out of time, right? Yeah. That's, I feel like I didn't like, Jerry Seinfeld have a thing about like, why do old people drive slow? They should be like driving fast. Yeah. I think that, I can't remember exactly the bit of the comic, but yeah, it is, I'm getting way off topic here, but that is a strange thing that you learn patience as you get older. Also, if you're me, you have therapy and medication that have
helped. Well, sure.
all right, Tyler, you're up.
Okay, so I was split between two, so I'll mention one, which is a cheat, and then I'll talk about the other one. I'm going to mention Mia Goth in Infinity Pool. Man, oh man.
Yeah, I'll just chime in and say I greatly dislike Infinity Pool, but she is so good in it.
Yeah, and I genuinely like the movie, but like,
yeah.
But man, oh man, that is a
yeah.
That performance, that character is tough sledding.
Yeah.
But I will be talking about Patti LuPone in Beau is Afraid. Man, the, like the one character that's worse. So I don't want to get too deep into Beau's Afraid because I'm certainly going to be talking about it in a couple weeks, but what I will say is that the premise of it is that it's the world through the eyes of someone who deals with anxiety, depression, shame, guilt, all that stuff. And so none of the actors are playing real characters.
No.
They're playing characters as seen by someone who has all these filters on. So of course when you're playing this character's mother, there's going to be a lot of layers to that. And Patti LuPone manages to be, man oh man, just everything that she needs to be in this context. She is domineering. She is a little bit charming. She is constantly shaming. And she knows just how to play all of these notes so that she's not just one thing. Because obviously, even though he might see her predominantly one way, he understands that there's a lot of different elements to her, but every single element, even the positive ones, are still seen through his eyes. So she has to do that. She can't, and I can't imagine how difficult that must be for an actor to not actually play a character as is, but you have to play a character completely as they are seen and perceived instead of what they might actually be. And so when so every scene she's in, she just totally takes over, as she should, and she's terrifying, and you also hate her, but you also deeply want her approval, and she manages to capture all of that. And I don't think I've ever seen her do anything like this before, and I thought it was just wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have much to add. I mean, yeah. I'm going to take a... Because I don't know. Scott's always saying, like, in episodes like this, if I bring up a movie that he doesn't like, he doesn't want to dwell on that. Sure. So I think Beau is Afraid is Ari Aster's best movie, whatever you want to make of that. But I think the third act of the movie is the weakest, but that doesn't mean she's not great in it.
Oh, man.
I'm pretty high on the movie. I mean, I do think it starts at the strongest point. I mean, I could not stop laughing at the first 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And seeing that with the crowd was so much fun that it's hard for the movie to ever kind of crescendo past that. But I think it's a pretty strong piece of work.
I mean, this is my problem with Ari Aster, is that the best stuff happens at the beginning of his movies, you know, or at least the most impactful stuff happens right at the beginning, and it never... Like, that's my problem. Like, Midsommar, which is mostly good, like, kicks off with something so horrific that I never feel like... Yeah, more horrific stuff happens as the movie goes on, but it's not escalating. It's not dialing up.
I mean, I think to Beau's credit, it escalates and it keeps reinventing itself in strange ways. It's just, like, it's seeing that movie opening weekend with a crowd that, like... None of us really knew what the movie was going to be about.
Yeah.
And the way that first 30 minutes takes off is like, is just so enjoyable. And the movie never gets more enjoyable is the only thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like, you can't say a movie that ends with a giant penis monster isn't in some way escalating.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that was going to be my pick for supporting actor.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. I watched that on an airplane, so maybe that affected
it. Yeah, I watched it by myself in here late at night. And, like, in that first 30 minutes, I was like, I thought, this is amazing, but boy, I'm pretty exhausted already. Oh, it's 3 hours. Oh, okay. All right, so next I think we'll do... I think next we'll do director.
All right.
My pick here is another Christian Mungiu for RMN. And just on a purely skill level, he's such an accomplished filmmaker in terms of how much he's able to get into each frame. You know, most of his scenes, if not all of his scenes, take place in a single shot. And that the skill with which he blocking actors is one of those things that, like, you kind of feel like has fallen off in terms of routine talent that you see in most movies, but he's really one of the great exemplars of it of all time, and certainly of modern era. But there's also a way in which that can become too literal. And what's exciting about RMN in comparison to his prior films, all of which I've loved, but RMN has a slight air of surreality that I really didn't expect from him at all, and from the way the movie is set up, which is kind of this, like, it's been a long time since I've seen, or a while since I've seen it anyway, but it's kind of like a class agitation film about, like, people in town being frustrated with their wages and taking out on immigration and all this kind of, like, geopolitical kind of contemporary sociopolitical stuff. But then it just becomes more and more inward looking as the film goes on, without really changing its aesthetic structure to such an extent that I literally, after exiting the movie, Googled RMN ending explained and mysteriously found a result for it that did assure me that the ending was as surreal as I read it. I didn't just miss something entirely. But yeah, it was a really exciting evolution for Munju, who's a filmmaker who, as exciting and amazing as his films are, does seem like he could have gotten himself into a rut by this point, but no, he's still got more avenues to go down. So yeah, that's my pick.
Okay. Yeah, it's probably been even longer since I've seen it, because I saw it at Toronto in 2022. But yeah, it is fantastically well directed, and it is, I guess, like, looking back at his films, at something like Graduation, it maybe shouldn't have been surprising that he could make what is essentially a thriller by the end.
Oh, but all his movies are kind of thrillers.
Yeah, but I don't think I thought of him because there's not as many, like, guns as there are at the end of RMN. Yeah, it's a great, fascinating movie. And he to go back to what you're saying about the setting or the class and immigration thing, the movie is intentionally set in Transylvania in Romania,
right?
A part of Romania that is full of immigrants and people who he intentionally picked a place where there's a lot of different languages spoken.
Yeah,
because totally. You can see. I know when I saw it, I'm not sure if you saw it, had the same conceit that different language subtitles are in different colors.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Because there's, like, Romanian is spoken, but also there's English and there's French and there's, like, Hungarian and then you've got the characters who come from Africa and there's, like, everything has its own color. So much that I couldn't even... There are so many languages spoken.
Oh, yeah. It'd be impossible. But it kind
of,
like...
When I wrote my review from TIFF, I did list every language that was spoken in the movie, just to show there's got to be, like, 7 or 8 different languages there.
Yeah. I think... Then, like, the first language you hear and the subtitles you see are, like, what they've color-coded as purple. I remember it being not, like, white or yellow, and I was like, we gotta look at this the whole goddamn movie. And I was like, oh, okay, I see what they're doing.
Yeah. Okay, director. I am going with a personal favorite director who I think has been criminally overlooked this award, and whose film has been criminally overlooked this award season. I'm going with Sofia Coppola for Priscilla. Yeah. The comparison that I have thought of, does anyone remember in the movie Sideways, Paul Giamatti has a little monologue about why he loves Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is because he's clearly talking about himself in the movie, right. But he's talking about the grapes being very, like, sensitive and temperamental, and they have to be handled just right. You can't go too hot or too cold, you know? And I feel like Priscilla is, like, a really well-made Pinot Noir that... In a different way, there is just as much control exerted over this movie as Jonathan Glazer exerted over The Zone of Interest, but whereas Jonathan Glazer is, like, holding on tight to keep the movie on the same path, there's a very, very light touch with Sofia Coppola. And I think that's true of all her movies, but I was really especially moved by this one, and I think it really this is a movie that I was loving the whole time, but sometimes there are movies where, like, the ending is, like, it's not that the ending changes things, it's that you realize how perfect the movie was. That the ending of Priscilla, and I think this might be why it's not more of an awards movie, there's no big like Oscar clip like speech that Priscilla right. gets to make to like stand up for herself or whatever. It's very subdued, but it's like the least subdued she's been the whole movie, and so it feels huge. And we talked about it a little bit in the Needle Drops episode, that there's the Dolly Parton needle drop at the end there. It's a really just a masterfully crafted, meticulous and gentle type of movie. And yeah, maybe too subtle for awards bodies, I guess.
Well, and that within that control, it can still be like kind of funny. I really think of like Elvis's posse.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
just like the goofiest bunch of dorks. So good.
Yeah, I one of my other rules for this episode is not to repeat movies.
Sure.
But Jacob Elordi for supporting actor was something
I considered.
Haven't
done
it to it yet. I considered it.
Yeah.
But I had already settled on Sofia Coppola, so I didn't go with him.
Yeah, you mentioned that the film is overlooked. That includes by me. I actually do have access to it, but I keep forgetting about it, even though I love Sofia Coppola and like her movies are often like in my top five of that year. And I know that I'll love Priscilla. Like, you know, anytime she makes movies about either about or is like, or movies that are like adjacent to show business, I'm always fascinated to know what she has to say.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I definitely have to prioritize that one. Okay, so my choice, I don't want to talk too much about it, because once again, I'll be talking about it in my top 10. But I feel like I would be remiss if I did not talk about what I would consider the prize of most improved. And that is Emerald Fennell, however you say it. I don't think any of us really liked Promising Young Woman, right?
Nope.
Yeah, and David, I believe one of our big notes is we thought it wasn't risky enough. I guess word got back to her because Saltburn is just like now would have been a time for her to sort of like play it safe a little bit. And she does exactly the opposite, and she totally commits to the movie she's making and makes it funny and disturbing and everything that it needs to be. Everything that I think Promising Young Woman wasn't is what I think Saltburn is. And I was just so... I was reluctant to watch it because I didn't like her first film, and I'm so glad I did. It's just a film that, like, it just kept throwing me for a loop in only good ways. I really loved it, and I think she did. Now I can't wait to see what her next film is.
Yeah, when we talked about it on the fall preview, I was like, I don't know, I think I'm kind of looking forward to it, because sometimes you get those second features where, like, the first feature is, like, them kind of, like, testing the waters.
Yeah.
It meets enough success that they really let loose.
Yeah.
And sometimes and for that reason, I often like the second features much more than the first. Mm. And I was very thrilled to see that was the case here.
Yeah, you were right. I was wrong, because the fall movie preview, I was like, this is...
There's no way.
Least anticipated movie of the fall, because I was not looking forward to it. But, yeah, I'm also curious to see what she does next, because the movie is... I mean, it's all anecdotal because these streaming services don't tell you what the numbers are, but it seems to be a big success, even though it's not getting the awards attention.
Yeah.
And I don't think it made that big a mark at the box office.
But
and there's definitely not a guarantee that everybody that watched it has a favorable opinion of it.
Well, that's for sure, yeah.
In talking to people here, like staff members, they all watched it. I don't think any of them liked it.
But still, they... They all watched it.
They clicked it.
But yeah, I mean, there is a certain measure of a movie's success in like how memed it is, and I feel like
totally.
This is a much memed movie.
Yeah.
Good for her.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, next I think we'll do our wild card.
All right.
All right,
Scott. What do you got?
I went with the production design for Inside.
Yes. Damn right.
I know it was a movie Tyler set up because the two of us were the only people who put Willem Dafoe on our best actor ballot for the BPs.
And I think I almost put Inside for production design.
Yeah, it was... I'm pretty sure I had number one on my list there, but it immediately stood out when I was kind of cruising through thinking of a wild card. So Inside is a movie where Willem Dafoe breaks into a rich guy's penthouse apartment to steal some art and gets trapped inside. And, you know, there's some voices on phones and stuff like that. I think maybe we glimpse some people in security footage, but for the most part, it's like the Willem Dafoe show.
Yeah.
And as I told Julie when we left the movie, I was like, this is my ideal kind of movie, which is you pour Willem Dafoe into basically an empty box and let him loose.
Yeah.
But the production design really like works in tandem with his performance, and it becomes this like constantly changing and ever morphing way of expressing the character as much as anything Dafoe is doing, as he like finds the limits of what the apartment can offer him and demolishes it, but not in like a strictly realist way where like he's constantly like, I mean, he does like find new food sources and like finds a way to sustain himself in like the way of like Ridley Scott's The Martian or something like that. But it also like sometimes the way he constructs things feels more like an artistic expression than a strictly survival one. I think especially of like the structure he builds to reach.
Yeah.
Is that like the fire extinguisher or the sprinkler system? I can't remember what he's trying to get to.
Or no, he's trying the ceiling. To get to like
the glass ceiling,
like
right?
A skylight.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But that whole structure, like...
That damn glass ceiling.
We're all just trying to smash it, even Willem Dafoe. But yeah, that whole structure is just like such a weird mishmash of furniture and other objects throughout the film, but becomes like... this expressive side of the character that we don't have access to, that you can't really put into words, but which only makes sense as this kind of like built object. And the more he like finds different rooms in the house and those come to like expand the character as well. It's just such a fascinating movie that I really wish more people had seen, because I found it so interesting.
It really I feel like our listeners would like it a lot. But I could see some people not really responding to it because, you know, the character doesn't, like, spell out his motivation or anything like that. It's just totally in the moment. And also, it's like, I don't think his motivation really matters anymore.
No, we roll past that stage pretty immediately.
Exactly. It's like, there is really only now.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think it's a great-looking movie. I think his performance is wonderful, and... Yeah, I feel like if this year were, if people just looked at it from a different angle, like, he would definitely be like a best actor nominee, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to take a moment to do one of my favorite things and talk about my arcane rules for eligibility for these, which are my public lists. So I have a private list. In my private list... is just movies that premiered in 2023.
Yeah.
For the public list, a movie has to have both premiered in 2023, and I used to say also been released in the U.S. in 2023. I've, over the years, softened that to be it has to have premiered in 2023 and be released in the U.S. Before we do our top 10.
You're such a fucking sellout.
So that's why I'm lucky, because that I'm just... barely able to put this beautiful movie on these lists because it's out like this weekend. I'm picking, I should have looked up how to pronounce the director's name, Bas Devos. His movie is called, new movie is called Here.
Oh, right.
And I am going to highlight, there's a lot of things to get highlighted about the movie, but I'm going to highlight the editing. Because the movie just glides, much like the characters are. The movie, sort of to different ends, some at different ends, but similar to RMN, the movie is set in Brussels at a place that I read an interview with Devos where he talked about why he said it, why he told the story that he told, where he told that Brussels is also very much an immigrant heavy place, and the movie is about two immigrants, a Romanian, again like in RMN, a Romanian and a Chinese woman, and the Romanian man works construction, but he's just like finished one job and he has like some time off and he's about to go back to Romania, And then this woman that he meets is soon to return to China, I think for good, if I remember correctly. But the movie sort of, it takes place in that kind of nowhere space between, like, he's finished the job, but his plane isn't for a couple days, so he's got basically just, like, a couple days to, like, hang out in Brussels, and what he decides to do, because he wants to unplug his fridge while he goes away to not use the energy, he decides to make some soup and walk around the city, like, delivering soup to his friends before he goes off. And in doing so, he has a meet cute with this Chinese woman, and they sort of develop the early stages of, I guess, a romance, but also they're both on, you know, borrowed time in the city. So, but it has that, the movie has that feeling of kind of like those times when you're like, so I tend to be a planner, and Natalie is too, when we're on vacation. There's a lot of like, we want to see this museum, we want to go to see a show and stuff like that. But sometimes when you're on vacation, you do just have a day, or you even just have an afternoon to just like hang out, and there are no demands on your time. There are no real worries, and the movie very much, and I think a lot of it is in the editing, creates that feel of this is like just extra time that these characters have to just hang out. Even though they both live in Brussels, it has a sort of what Tom Anderson would call a high tourist eye for Brussels. Looking at everything, you know, looking at the bus lanes or whatever, the local restaurants and stuff, through this inquisitive, curious eye. But the editing, which even though by its nature editing is fourth dimensional, is moving you toward a thing, the editing reinforces this feel of this is almost somnambulant, soporific.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Absolutely beautiful movie, and hey, people, especially if you're in New York or LA, you're lucky. You can go see it like right now.
All right. So.
Oh wait, I forgot to say.
All right, good.
That coincidentally, even though I should have named the editor, I didn't. Did you name the production designer of Inside?
Yeah. Okay. I'm an asshole.
The woman. The Chinese woman in the movie is a non-professional actor. She is actually a film editor who has worked for Wang Bing, among others, but she is not the editor of the movie. Just thought that was interesting.
That is odd.
Thing. Okay.
All right, so... Okay, so I'm gonna... This is gonna be a pretty massive cheat.
Sweet.
I'm not proud of myself for this, but... I don't know any other time I'll be able to talk about it. So, rather than talk about one individual contributing to a much larger tapestry, I'm going to talk about the tapestry contributing to one individual scene.
Okay.
All right?
Okay.
I'm letting myself off the hook, 'cause I love this scene so much, and it's in a big blockbuster, and that is from Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, and it is the hallway scene, the hallway fight. Now, we've seen a lot of hallway fights in superhero movies and action movies in general, but those have always been, in video game terms, side-scrollers, whereas this one is a lot more three-dimensional, and so basically, our heroes have to get from one place to another, and in between is probably a hallway that's like 150 feet, and it's full of enemies. So they have to go in and fight all these enemies. Okay, fair enough. And James Gunn puts all underneath or on top of the song "No Sleep Till Brooklyn." Okay, fine. It's the structure of it that really works for me, combined with the cinematography, the editing, the choreography, and the acting. Always working together to show, like, one of my, you know, a long time ago, David, we did an episode on, like, the things that we just, like, individual things we really like to see. And one of the things I really love, I mean, I talked about it with how to blow up a pipeline, is, like, when you see a team and you see what every person brings to it, and that everybody is different. And so with this, everyone's fighting at the same time, but the camera will go through and focus on one member of the team at a time, and you get to see, like, their different fighting style, and so the editing and the cinematography, it changes depending on who you are following in that moment, and so you're seeing all these individual elements coming together to accomplish a larger goal, and that's very much a thing that I like. But I also think it's just done really well. It's something that I feel like we don't give James Gunn enough credit. We think of him as, like, yeah, he's like a fun writer and all that, but I think over the years he's definitely come to really evolve and be really good at directing action. And doing it in a way that feels appropriate for the characters and appropriate for for the tone of the film at that moment. And so I really like that scene. I've gone back and watched it a couple of times because it's just, you know, it's, I mean, we see great action sequences all the time. But this one is so rooted in individual characters and the team as a whole that I just really liked it. And yes, so I know that's a cheat. I'm talking about an individual scene, but that's what I chose to go with.
It's all right. I'll have a cheat coming up.
Good.
I have not seen Guardians 3. I kind of feel like I want to.
It's pretty good.
Like it.
I mean, yeah, I've seen the other two. I liked them just fine.
Yeah.
It does feel like James Gunn maybe has been able to maintain more of himself in the Marvel machine than some of the other
directors. So, yeah.
Or maybe he's just taken over from Joss Whedon and sort of setting the tone.
Maybe,
sure.
Or Jon Favreau before him. I was going to say something else about that, but no, I don't remember. Anyway,
all right.
I should see it.
Yeah, I think you would like it. There's definitely some gross James Gunn stuff in there.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's always
fun.
Is
Stallone in it?
He is, yes.
Yeah.
That was one of the few, like, the Guardians 2, like, sort of, like, tag at the end or whatever, like, the post-credit scene.
Yeah.
Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah.
Or maybe that was a mid-credit scene. I can't remember. That was one of the few that actually I was like, I would like to see more of that character.
Yeah, oh no, he definitely plays a role in the film, and Nathan Fillion shows up, unsurprisingly, but also delightfully.
Yeah, he's really good.
Okay, so next up,
we will do
lead actress.
Here's my cheat category.
Okay, great.
All right, so instead of going with single actress for a single film, I went with single actress for three different films.
Okay.
To spotlight a French actress who Julie mentioned on our top 10 episode, Laura Calamy, who some listeners might know. She's on a French TV show called, French is called like 10%, but in the US it's on Netflix as Call My Agent, which is like, calling it Entourage for the French is too trite a term, but it's basically like behind the scenes of a actor's agency, and so every episode a different famous actor guest stars, and it's about like something about their career not working. The one I always point to, which is fun for people who follow Isabelle Huppert's career, is her episode is about her trying to make two movies at once, basically, and she overbooked herself, which if you follow Isabelle Huppert's career is spot on. Anyway, so Laura Calamy is probably familiar to some listeners for that, but she's really staked out a great claim as lead actress in three different films this year. I think the one that got the most notice was Full Time, in which she plays a single mother trying to navigate a French rail strike and commute to Paris for her job as a she's essentially like the head of the cleaning staff at a hotel, at a high-end hotel, while also interviewing for a much better job. And it's as like tense as a Bourne movie or something like that, of like just the relentlessness of her life and all things she has to juggle. And she's so good at expressing that kind of constant terror that comes when you're living not quite at the margins, but kind of hand to mouth and kind of paycheck to paycheck, of like if any single element of her life starts to fall apart, her whole life will tumble, and several elements of her life start to fall apart. And then in a very different register, she was in a movie called The Origin of Evil, which is kind of like Parasite, but even more chaotic. It's about a woman who goes to visit her father. She's kind of like down and out, and her father has long been estranged from her life because he had her with a woman he was having an affair with, and so he never really had anything to do with her, but he's very wealthy, and so she suspects she can get something from him. And more revelations start to unfurl about the nature of her and the nature of their relationship, and she has to play a lot of dualities and even trialities, I guess you would say, throughout the film. And it's just such a great showcase for someone who's as multi-talented as her. And then finally, in a pure fun blast, she's in a kind of like friendship comedy called Two Tickets to Greece, where it's her and this friend that she grew up with, and they're kind of like reconnecting and going to Greece together. And her friend is this like way too buttoned up person. I think a lot of the film's flaws stem from her, that character being a little too limited. But Laura Calamy gets to play her like free-willing, free-spirited best friend who like is just like willing to do whatever anytime for a good time. And she's so much fun in there. She's an actress who I kind of had my eye on. She's been playing supporting roles in a lot of films over the past few years, but this was like really a big breakout year for her as a lead actress. And especially full-time in Origin of Evil, but even Two Tickets to Greece are all really worth seeing, especially for her.
All right. I was looking up to see if I'd seen her in anything, and I have seen... She was in a movie that actually is going to come up on a Patreon that you and I have already recorded. Everybody, patreon.com/battleshipattention. She was in Only the Animals.
Oh, yeah.
She is the one who finds the dead dog in that guy's barn, if you remember that. So good for her.
Yeah,
I should watch these movies.
Yeah,
and call my agent. Lead actress. I am going with Talia Ryder from The Sweet East. Talia Ryder was great in Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always.
There you go.
Yeah. Once I remember which one it starts with, I can remember, because it's a progression.
Yeah.
Starts with Never. Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. This is a fascinating performance in The Sweet East, because she's
very different.
She's clearly the lead. The entire movie centers on her, except she's almost completely, but not completely, a passive character that things happen to. What makes the performance and I guess the screenplay so juicy are those moments when she's not that, you know. The story is she's a high school student on a field trip to the capital. The capital being Washington, D.C., the capital of these United States of America. An incident that I won't spoil for people. She gets separated from her class, ends up falling in first with a gang of anarchic environmental activists.
Yeah.
Who are mostly a bunch of dumb fuck ups. And then from there, she gets involved with a sort of academic white supremacist.
Yeah.
And then she gets involved in a movie shoot, and then she keeps like bouncing from thing to thing, and she sort of goes with the flow, adapts to what is needed, but then there are little things that I love, and again, the things that I'm saying are in the screenplay, but Talia Ryder plays them very, very well. With the academic white supremacist guy, she mostly goes along, but she has a way of getting what she wants from him, you know? you know, leaving the door open while she takes a bath and announcing that she's going to do so, for one. And then there's other things like later, kind of like how Tony Soprano would reappropriate things that Melfi said to him in therapy.
Yeah.
There's things that that other characters have said to her earlier, and you think she's just this like passive thing, but she's clearly sponging it up because she repeats something that Simon Rex said to her to Jacob Elordi later in the movie, but makes it her own. It's a great role. It's a great screenplay. Although, yeah, every time I gotta stay off of Twitter because the screenwriter is made a fool of himself this week.
Well, he's had a long history of doing that.
Yeah,
I love Nick Pinkerton, but he's you know,
right? How did he make a fool of himself?
He like called out a theater in Cincinnati, I think.
Yeah,
They tried to book the Sweet East. And then ended up booking it somewhere else. And he called them out for not returning his emails. And they were like, we have the receipts. And like, you the ball was in your court as of like last November. You were supposed to get back to us. But they weren't mean about it. They were like, looks like you're having a great run at this other thing. Like, they were super nice.
Yeah.
And he just kept being a dick about it.
You can see how that would produce the screenplay for the Sweet East, though. I mean, it's like, this is like the thing of people. I mean, you can take this as far as you want of like, everyone. Any kind of like vague rudeness being under the guise of being problematic, but it's like sometimes you're not going to get these weird movies without some people being assholes sometimes.
Yeah, I'm not, I don't care that Nick Pinkerton is a baby about this movie theater. The movie's still great, and Tally Ryder is great in it. It feels like, I don't know, I've said versions of this before that like one great performance is a great performance, two great performances is a great actor.
Sure.
And that's how I feel about Tally Ryder now, having seen Never Really, Sometimes Always and this.
Well, and the way she, like, because I don't really think she's passive. I think she's accepting of, like, this weird journey that she ends up going on. But I think the way in which the character has to reappropriate things that she's heard before, but in a way that kind of weaponizes those things of, like, you can see even as she's, like, hearing other people talk and then choosing what to say in these new situations, her kind of like really just being a parasite to all these people and just like taking what she can from them and moving on and like not caring that it results, I mean, hilariously in several deaths along the way, but like it doesn't affect her. And that's really the satirical underbite of the film to me, is that it's about the way people can move between various modes in a society that has no real values and no real underpinning, and that you can constantly reinvent yourself.
Looking up her filmography, and it says she was in Spielberg's West Side Story. I don't remember her in that.
Yeah, I remember noticing that, but then I pulled up the cast list and she was so far down that I'm like, well, no wonder I don't remember.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, so my choice for lead actress, once again, I might get this name wrong, is Vivian O'Hara in Rye Lane. Did either of you see Rye Lane?
Yes, I saw it.
I did. I was a little mixed on it, but...
I liked it a lot more than I thought I was going to. And I thought she was really great. I like both of them, but I think she was really great because, and this is a script issue as well, but it has to, obviously it's going to affect the performance significantly. So essentially her character starts out as sort of your usual manic pixie dream girl. Like, that's kind of how she comes across. And I remember thinking like, nah, that's not what I want. But then, you know, the film decides to be, even though it's heavily stylized, it decides it wants to start to reflect an actual relationship between actual people. And so over time, we find like that some of the goofy stuff she does, or some of the free-spirited stuff she does, is rooted in like a very deep insecurity and maybe even a little bit of obsession with her past relationship and her own frustration with her own choices. And so I feel like she manages to, well, and that's the thing, is while she's being the manic pixie dream girl, she has to, as an actress, not fully commit to that, because the character knows that that's not who she is, it's just who she wishes she were. But also that it's part of her, it's just not maybe as visible a part of her as she would like it to be. And so she has to sort of play this underlying, for lack of a better term, sadness, or at the very least reservation, even in scenes where she's supposed to be fun and bubbly and all that sort of thing. But then when she flips, like, she can't, if she goes too dour with it, then it'll really seem like she's giving two different performances, as opposed to different sides of the same performance. And it's a character who is herself performing a little bit. And so I feel like she captures all of those and makes her into a fully developed character that I think is, you know, completely charming and obviously deeply flawed. And it can be very difficult when playing those two different aspects to not let one sort of take over the other, but she manages to do both, and I think it's a really remarkable performance.
I like the movie, I think, as a comedy more than other things. And I'm a sucker for a pun. And I love that they get Mexican food from a place called Love Guacchuli.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm skeptical of Mexican food in London. But I know I know that it has become more of a thing. And there's even like a Michelin-starred Mexican restaurant in London now. But I that's what I was thinking during watching the movie. I was like, I wonder if that's any good at all, Mexican food. But Love Guacchuli, that's pretty funny.
Yeah.
All right, final category.
Final category is supporting actor.
All right.
Scott, take us away.
I went with Kiefer Sutherland in the Caine Mutiny Court-Martial.
Oh, shit.
Did we pick the same person?
Yes, I'm going to scramble for a backup.
Oh, damn. That's crazy.
That's exactly what I had.
That is wild. So we talked about this on our Friedkin profile episode, but the film as a whole is a really smart modernization of the text, and keeps, and in fact, I think enhances all of its kind of like moral contradictions and uncertainties. And I really think that Sutherland's performance is very key to finding ways to express that in giving us somebody who's built up a degree of certainty in his life that's come as much from routine and habit as anything else. And when he's finally put under examination of that, doesn't really have a lot of places to go in terms of explaining himself, but is also frustrated that he has to explain himself, but is submissive to the process and wants to be kind of a good soldier in giving himself over, while also feeling like he's built up a degree of goodwill that he shouldn't need to be. And there's all these great contradictions that aren't explicated in the text. He doesn't really have a huge meltdown where he lays all this out. It's just all kind of in his physicality, that like kind of habit he does with his hand, and in the way he like dodges with his eyes, trying to have a direct answer to any given question, and tries to give like the softest answer. And it's just a really smart performance that is kind of a scene stealing performance, but not in a way we typically think of. He's just really fascinating to look at and really fascinating to consider as kind of a person who's at the center of this inquiry, but only has so much control over himself in order to answer for it, and really adds then to the film's ambiguity in terms of how much we can know, because this is a guy who hasn't really had to confront himself and is being forced to for the first time. Let David say something about it, at least, because it was his impulsive choice.
I guess Kiefer Sutherland, you know, especially like post 24, Jack Bauer has come to be, he's kind of a rugged, tough guy, action star type of persona. But my favorite performances are when we're reminded that he could be a bag of neuroses, you know, like this, or Melancholia, or Fire Walk With Me, or
I feel like Dark City, maybe.
Dark City, yeah. And I'm sure these aren't good movies, but soft spot in my heart for the Young Guns movies that I want because I watched them so much as a kid. So it's fun to see him flex muscles, you know. That's because in some ways he is like, or at least thinks of himself as the self-possessed man of action type. But he's also the paranoic. So as a last minute replacement, and just to continue to needle Scott because he hates this movie, I'm going to pick Greg Turkington in Fremont.
Oh God, the worst part of that movie.
Part of this is just surprise because if you know Greg Turkington, you probably know him as Neil Hamburger, his comic persona, who he performed stand-up as for years and years and then did a whole movie as with Rick Alverson's Entertainment. And his therapist here is much different, much gentler, but also equally funny in his own way. Most of the funniest stuff that happens in the movie, I think, is him, you know. You know, even like in the middle of her breakthrough about White Fang, and he starts crying. He reads from White Fang, which is a very moving part, but then he starts crying, but then she refers to White Fang as a dog, and like through his snot and tears, he's like, he's a wolf. I like that stuff. And also because I saw, I think I talked about this on our Needle Drops episode, actually. I went to a Q&A. I saw a screen that had a Q&A afterwards with the star and the director and Greg Turkington, and he talked about how he's, you know, as a stand-up or in entertainment or in the comedy in the Rick Alverson movie or even in like fucking Ant-Man or whatever, he's generally been cast by people who want him to improvise because that's what he does. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't improvise almost at all in this movie, partially because the actress's English is even worse than the character's is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. So if he improvised, she would lose her place in the script. So like, I'm picking him as a last minute pick to replace Kiefer Sutherland, partially because I know this is such a different role for him.
All right,
stay in your lane, Greg Turkington.
I had heard about Fremont. I haven't watched it yet, but when I found out that he was in it, I was actually more inclined to watch it because I'm kind of a Turkington head. So I've got two options here, and I think both of them are amazing, and I'm not sure which one to talk about.
Is this why you made this category last? You thought there'd be some inspiration strike?
And you still didn't decide.
And why I insisted, Scott, that you go first, because I thought you might have one of these.
Oh,
guys.
Dang.
Okay.
Well, we should at least mention both.
Okay. Yeah, all right. So one is Dave Bautista in Knock at the Cabin.
I certainly thought about him.
Yeah.
But again, he was on my top. The film was on my top 10 list, so I wouldn't have factored in.
And then the second one is Donnie Yen in John Wick Chapter 4.
Another one I definitely considered.
Yeah.
I think I'll go with Donnie Yen. Even though, I mean, I feel like I could write an entire paper about what Dave Bautista is doing in Knock at the Cabin. It's really amazing. But Donnie Yen... So, David, I remember you and I, when we talked about Don't Breathe, something that we liked was that even in the midst of, like, a chase scene within the house, the blind man would occasionally like touch parts of the room, because you know he needs to know where he is, and that's the only way to do it. And so one thing that I love about this character in John Wick is that he is always completely aware of his surroundings, and you see the various ways that he gets in touch with them, whether it be like sort of sliding along a cabinet or whatever you want to call it in the kitchen. And he's just, you know, it's hard to believe that a blind character could do as much damage as he does. So they really need to sell it in a universe where there's a lot of outlandish things going on. And I think they do sell it. And I think Donnie Yen absolutely sells it by, you know, this character is blind, so he has to be so reliant on his body, even if he wasn't, constantly fighting and killing people. And so he makes his character, this is not like a hard thing for Donnie Yen to do, but like the character is just so physical and just so in tune with every tiny thing that he might touch and knowing like what that might mean. And the character, like on top of that, like making this character's life even vaguely feasible to the viewer, but then also adding in layers of being sympathetic, so that we, you know, we're, it's a tough situation where like, of course we're rooting for John Wick, but for John Wick to win, it means this guy has to lose.
Right.
And we don't want him to lose. And so like, he had to be very much, he couldn't just be like a sympathetic villain, because we still root for them to lose. He has to be basically like a co-hero, and certainly the hero in his own movie. And so he manages to layer on all these things so that the film could, when the film veers off to follow him, we're just as excited, if not more so, than when we're following John. And so I think it's a very confident performance. And I think, again, it's just a very common thing that I've been saying today, is I really like performances that are like in the moment. And by the nature of the character, Donnie Yen has to be in the moment. He can't think about, like, he can't be distant. He can't be preoccupied, because everything about this character's life and the limitations that he has requires him to be completely tactile with the environment around him and the circumstances around him. And I think he does just a wonderful job with that.
Yeah, everything you said, and also a couple other things. I like that he is one of the badass action stars of the movie, but he's also, in a lot of times, the movie's comic relief
same
time, which is great. And part of that is that I love that, like, for three movies so far, we've seen a world that is so governed by these rules. And every character seems to either be strictly adhering to the rules or radically rebelling against them.
Right.
He's the guy who's just like, yeah, I guess these are the rules that I have to follow to do this. And just, like, he has this kind of like, all right, you know, like, you know, sometimes, I love my job, but then sometimes there's little like administrative things that I have to do with it. And that kind of feels like how he approaches things.
Yeah, he's like Nick Nolte. He's like, hell.
Yeah. You and I both nominated him for BPs, but
I did too.
Yeah,
oh, really?
I think we all had him too far down on the list because
a few other people did too.
Yeah, so he didn't make the cut for the BP nomination.
Too bad.
And he's just so cool.
Yeah,
I don't really have usually that thing of like the male thing of like, oh, that action star is so cool. But Donnie Yen, John Wick 4, he's so cool.
Yeah, I did. I think she's in the movie too much. Speaking of John Wick and the BPs, I considered Rina Sawayama for the McGill, but I think she might be in the movie too much.
Who does she play?
She's the concierge slash daughter at the Japanese.
Oh,
the
man.
Tokyo.
Close. It's a real close.
I would guess she's in it too much, partially just because that movie's pretty long and she takes up a sizable part.
And also because this is a super technicality. But we talked, my specific rule for McGill is that it has to be not just 15 minutes of screen time, but 15 minutes from first to last appearance. If you stayed through the end credits of John Wick Chapter 4, it's way after, more than 15 minutes. It's 3 hours later.
Interesting.
She's in the end credits scene.
I did not know that was one of your dumb rules.
We've talked about it before.
I know. I guess I forgot.
Huh. Because I feel like that's the nature of the Bruce McGill inside
performance. I'd say that's probably true, yes.
Is that it's not just the 15 minutes, it's that he's basically got two scenes back-to-back.
I think almost by default it winds up being that.
I don't know, but
like that I think about.
The one I always point out is that Jenny Slate for On the Rocks got the nomination. She's in the whole movie. She's just in little
bits.
All right. That's it.
Yeah.
That's the episode. You can find reviews of a bunch of these movies at BattleshipRetention.com. You can email us at David@BattleshipRetention.com or Tyler@BattleshipRetention.com. Find me on Twitter or Blue Sky at Davey Pretension, on Letterboxd at David Backs. My other podcast that I do with my wife is called The One Where I Met Your Mother. You can find that at BattleshipRetention.com. That's what I got going on. Tyler, what do you got going on?
Not much these days. Once again, check out the GoFundMe to help me pay for my physical therapy and my mental therapy, as well as a dedicated CNA. We're getting to the point where, I mean, we've got a sizable chunk of money, but we still have a ways to go. And so, but we're getting to the point where I can probably start hiring people, which is exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pinned to the top of the homepage at BattleshipRetention.com, and there's a video accompanying it that tells you exactly how the money that you'd be donating is going to be spent.
Yeah.
Scott?
Yeah, Twitter and Blue Sky, Rail of Tomorrow, and just Scott and I at Letterboxd. And that's it. I will have a review up on the site, not quite by the time this episode goes up, of the new Criterion release of Nothing But a Man.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Well, thanks, Scott, for joining us.
Yep.
Thank you at home for listening.
We'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye.